My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Hi, and good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world. I'm Renan Ashkenazi from Grow Ventures, and I'm excited to host this series on winning the deal, the before and the after. Let's hear from my guest today.
Hi, everyone. My guest today was born in South Africa, raised in Texas, and found himself eventually investing from Tel Aviv. He has more than 21 M&As and IPO exits under his belt, including Wix, Habana, Fiverr, and those are just my personal favorites. The legend around him, and I'm not even sure he's aware, is that throughout his career, there was less than a handful of times where he only returned the money on his investments. Adam Fisher, a partner at Bessemer. I'm a big fan, and it's great to have you with me today.
Thank you.
You're considered one of the safest bets in Israel. Your investment decisions prove themselves time after time after time. And we talk a lot in this show about decision making. How do you reach conviction? And I was wondering if for you, was it more gut, mind, heart, a combination? Do you have a framework or a process for reaching conviction?
I believe I do. I'm an early stage investor, which means I'm generally investing in a team. Maybe there's a product. Maybe there's just a direction. Maybe there's some initial business or some metrics that I can look at. But for me, most of that is incidental, anecdotal. It's not always particularly telling about the future. So I'm left with two general things. The first is that by far the most important, it's the team. And everybody says, or a lot of VCs will say they invest in the team. But I believe everybody actually means something slightly different. And of course, everybody has their own kind of people or team they're looking for. Just like we each look for somebody different as a life partner, or somebody different as a friend or a mentor. So I look for something very specific in the teams I back. Of course, I'm primarily focused on the CEO. It's someone who has confidence, but not ego, who is a leader and ideally also a great communicator. Somebody who really knows what they're talking about, not necessarily because they're the expert. Sometimes that's because they've been 10 years in that particular field, but oftentimes it's because they're just a quick study. And that usually is very telling about the person's personality in the future. I'm betting on a team that can make the most out of the advantages that startups have, which is they have agility. They have the ability to change up anything they want. They can abandon their plan. They can scrap their product. They can screw over customers and do something better and more interesting. So I'm looking for a team that can take advantage of that. That's obviously the proverbial plan B. But not every team is that entrepreneurial that they can both come with an initial idea and then change it up. And I've seen that multiple times. Sometimes it's what you would call kind of small incremental changes. Sometimes it's an outright pivot. But that's part of what I look for, the ability to take advantage of those opportunities. And then when it comes, you know, beyond a team, or with regards to the team, I'm still looking for somebody or a team that I think can bring the company to success. I don't look for teams that I think will be able to manage a public company or teams that can build it into a unicorn. That's really easy to say. I mean, investors say that. That's not really something that's written on somebody's forehead. And I can say it because the companies, my biggest outcomes, the IPOs that I've had, were not teams that I thought could take it to IPO at the time of my investment, which was generally the Series A investment. I think it's very misleading to look for that. And it's very wrong to expect it. Over a long period of time that takes to build a company and for it to mature, those individuals, those leaders will mature themselves, just like we do as investors. So you really look into the future and think, well, can this person just get it to success? Because that's ultimately what we're looking to do as investors, is get successes, make the most of them, hopefully optimize them, and avoid uncomfortable, painful losses. But losses do happen. You don't have control over everything. And so I also look for teams that I actually want to work with so much that even if failure is the outcome, I think I'll have a good time working with them. And that'll be interesting and intellectually challenging. And so, yes, I actually look for teams that I don't mind failing with.
That's interesting. But it's also, it feels like it's almost the hardest thing to vet, right? You could vet the market. You could vet the technology. How do you approach vetting a team for all those things that you described? That some are really, some are very soft.
They are. That's why it's a skill, unlike being a surgeon or an airplane pilot. But there is something in our industry that is also, there is an expertise that's developed over time. It's also based on pattern recognition and repeating things over and over again. And of course, that's based on having seen hundreds, if not thousands, of entrepreneurs and startups, and recognizing what works for you. And ultimately, it's also how you get comfortable. Now, some newer investors can at least convince themselves that they can skip all that. Sometimes there are shortcuts by learning from others around them, if there are more experienced investors in their partnerships. But yes, a lot of it is very soft, and you learn it over time. I don't believe too much in shortcuts. I think there are investors that focus on sectors or focus on later stages and can use different methodology for approaching investment. But early stage, partnering with some of the best entrepreneurs, that takes time to acquire that skill. Now, that's not to say I don't have a strategy for all the sectors that I cover. I do. I don't have time to go into it. But when it comes to semiconductors, I know what I'm looking for. It doesn't change much from year to year, which is why I do very few semiconductor investments. But the ones I've invested in have largely been successful as a result of that. And it's usually a combination of not a specific trend, but I'm looking for certain things that are going to be required to make a company in that sector successful. And I'm looking to avoid certain things that I think will doom that company. So, and I have that in my mind about most sectors on a high level, but not everything. And there are areas where I'm just not familiar enough with, or I haven't spent enough time thinking about it.
But this takes us, and you said that there are no shortcuts, but this takes us to speed to conviction. And so much has been said about this, but competitive deals these days, and we probably have Tiger Global to thank for that, but competitive deals these days are probably the most competitive they've ever been in terms of pace. Because if you want to be relevant, then old models of due diligence are not relevant. Has there been any change in your process, in your mindset, when it comes to decision making in this pace, in this current pace today?
Look, the current environment is not healthy. I can understand the very fast speed at the growth stages, where there's a data room full of lots of data. You've got years of history to analyze. And if you have the team and you've done this before, you can really make a decision within days. When it's happening at the earlier stages, it's not right. It's not healthy. Again, we're talking about long-term partnerships. When I invest in a company, I'm looking for a team that I want to back. And ideally, though, that team is looking for a venture investor that they want to partner with also for what could be upwards of a decade. And I've had multiple investments that it's been, yes, a decade. So if you're talking about meeting a company at the early stage, and you're given a week to decide whether you want to be the first investor, and you may be working with them for the next decade, there's nothing responsible about that.
Right.
There's very little you could really learn in a week. And for the most part, you're also not meeting them every day. So it's not even that you have a full week to actually to engage with them. That's just the amount of time that passes. At most, you're probably getting three sessions with them, maybe only two face-to-face. So you're left with investors that don't care or don't understand, not to mention entrepreneurs that don't appreciate what they're doing in letting somebody in without due diligencing the investor. And you're kind of opening the path for yes, like hedge fund type investing, where they're investing in hundreds of companies in a given year, and you're just one of them. You know, we'll find out several years from now, or maybe it'll be longer than that, when things change, that there are a lot of bad decisions that were made on very little information. And on both ends, meaning entrepreneurs who chose the wrong investor, and of course, investors who chose the wrong project. These days, I turn down a lot of deals, a lot of teams that pretty much dictate a timeline that is irresponsible. You know, I meet them on a Monday, and they're saying they're expecting, they've already got one term sheet, and expecting to make a decision by Thursday or Friday. And I just politely say, you know, that's great. You know, congratulations. You know, unless it's somebody I already know, or unless it's a company I've met with in the past, I politely decline. And that's just not the kind of relationship I'm looking to build. And again, this is early stage. This is generally first institutional investing, perhaps the second institutional investor, but very often, very times, very soon after the first institutional round. And I don't like doing that.
I very much relate to what you're saying about this not being responsible for both sides, by the way, because you want the entrepreneur to get to know you just as much as you want to get to know them. The fit has to be double-sided. I was talking to an investor, and he said that he believes that the diligence is a process where you try to convince your head with what the gut said in the very first meeting. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
There's something to that. You know, there's so much uncertainty in this business. You could easily have, you know, paralyzed yourself trying to think whether you're making the right decision or not. I think what every investor has to accept is that you only have so much information, and you have no real crystal ball into the future. You have some data, you have the team, you have your intuition, but ultimately you have to make a decision. And that's not easy for a lot of people. That it's a lonely position to be in, and it can be nerve-wracking. And as I said, it can lead to paralysis. So what we do as investors is that we use various types of mental frameworks to convince ourselves that we've got a handle on the risk, or that we know how to narrow the risk, or that the potential is worth the risk. Like I said, for me, it's about the team, that I know how to work with this team and make sure we can figure it out. And I think that's what it's all about. It is. It's about explaining to yourself why, despite all the risk, why, despite all the uncertainty, you feel comfortable doing it. You know, it's like anything in life. We convince ourselves that you're going to be safe because you've got a safety belt on in the car. But statistically, we know that's not the case. Or you're going to be safe because you're healthy because you eat well and exercise. Well, we know that that's only part of the story. And of course, that's maybe it's a bit more extreme in the case of business, because it's not only about control or lack thereof of the startup. You don't control the competition. You don't control the customers. You don't control the potential acquirers or the other startups or the other investors who you're investing alongside. There's a tremendous...
Or global pandemics.
Right. Pandemic's another example. But it's just endless. And so you have to reach the point where you acknowledge the risks, you acknowledge uncertainty, and you work over time to lessen it, if not eliminate it. And that's what it's all about. You start with a certain amount of risk. And each one of us looks at it and says, one person will look at it and say, well, this is just too much for me. Another person will look at it and say, no, I've got a handle on this. I think I can live with that. I think we can work around that. And I think I know what will happen if this happens. And so, again, everybody develops their own frameworks. It might be thesis driven, might be team driven. It might be, you know, their own, there are various ways, but that's how you get to the point of making a decision in the face of so much uncertainty.
Yes. And you know, that makes me think about something else. You know, people talk, you talked about risks and mitigation, and people talk about the difference between when making an investment decision about thinking opportunity first versus risk first. And I was wondering what makes more sense to you, drilling on the risks when evaluating an opportunity or the positive outcomes? What would be the best possible positive outcome? And that, by the way, reminds me that I heard you once say that you never thought that Wix would be as big as it became. So drilling on the positive outcomes or the risks, what type of mindset do you typically stay in when evaluating opportunities?
Well, it's somewhat, you, you, it's harder to make that distinction without also taking consideration terms, how much you're investing relative to the size of your fund, the valuation. So, you know, looking at the potential, it's very helpful to think of very, very high potential outcomes when you have also at the same time a very high entry price. You know, you're thinking, wow, do I pay this much for this company? And then it helps you by realizing, well, you know, this could be really, really big if it's if it were. So that's helpful. I don't think there's a simple answer to whether you were looking at the risks or the opportunity. You know, we lay it out when we write an internal investment memo. We think about what can go wrong, what can go right. We do what we call an outcomes table. We apply some kind of percentages to it. It's more of a guide to think about, you know, is there a chance of losing our money? And is there a chance of doing 100x? We're obviously often wrong. In our best companies, we've exceeded our expectations by far. And we've also been surprised at how many times, you know, even performing companies won't be valued what we thought they were, their growth will slow, and we'll end up not losing our money, but getting just a little bit more than we invested. So I think you have to look at both sides, the risk and the opportunity. And of course, as you build a personal portfolio, you also have to think, are you trying to create a balanced portfolio with some things that are a bit higher risk, higher opportunity, other things that are slightly lower risk, but still have opportunity, and where you feel comfortable. I also think it's where you are in your career. I think an investor that has already generated hundreds of millions of dollars in gains can take more risk. They don't always do, but it is easier for them to make those decisions. When they do make a decision, they're not paralyzed by fear. And newer investors, they also have their, you know, various types. There are those that come in and are very cautious, and then there are those that come in, you know, swinging for a home run right away. So there are many different styles. There are many different ways for investors, new and more experienced, to come up with mental frameworks that work for them. I don't know if there's one that could be applied across the board.
Yeah, and I told you when we discussed earlier that I had a discussion about this with a much more rational colleague than me, and she argued that the best investors know to explain their gut because of their experience. They don't say something here doesn't feel right. They know to pinpoint the reason that the go-to-market wouldn't work. The growth path is proven to fail in this sector. You've done it all, you've seen it all, and now you can explain why you feel about this opportunity the way that you do.
Right. I would say the flip side is more important. When you're positive about it, I think you need to be able to explain it. A great way to explain it is by writing an investment memo. That's what we do at Bessemer. Putting it in words and memorializing it is really helpful. It often shows you how much you don't know or where the uncertainty is, but it forces you to confront things. You cannot use those terms, you know, my got a hunch or my gut tells me. You cannot put that in writing. Or at least your partners won't accept it. On the flip side, when something doesn't feel right, I don't know you need to explain it. Those are the kind of situations where I actually think it's fine to just walk away. You don't need to overanalyze why you don't like the entrepreneur. I don't think it's really worthwhile. If it's an existing investment of yours and something feels wrong, yes, you need to analyze it. But I think when you're walking away from an opportunity or declining one, I think that your gut is fine.
But that's a slippery slope, right? Because it's so much easier to say no to an opportunity, right? I mean, before an entrepreneur walks into my room, I can tell you why I can say no. And it's always going to be the same reasons when we're talking about early stage, right? Too early, the market hasn't matured, technology isn't proven, not enough customers, no financials that you could trust. So it's easy to say no. So wouldn't you want to be able to explain to yourself why you're saying no?
Yeah, of course you do. Perhaps I didn't explain myself properly. That's a cop-out to say it just doesn't feel right. I meant it as, you know, there's this reason and this reason, and there might be arguments, you know, countering it, saying, no, the data is interesting and so forth. Yeah. But you, when all things being equal, if you don't feel comfortable about the team, about the way they presented to you, about something that they're projecting in the year to come, it's fine to walk away. I wouldn't explain it that way to the entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. But of course, you need to analyze the business and have other justifications for why it's just not there.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about mental plasticity, and I've mentioned that to you before also. It's a term that I've just recently heard, and I really related to it. You've seen everything, and you've seen everything fail. How do you not attribute past failures to current opportunities? How do you keep an open mind to that founder that comes with a VR startup or a drone startup and not say, well, this is never going to happen because it was supposed to and it didn't so many times?
Yeah, again, that's part of the pattern recognition that I think we develop as investors. There's also, you know, the converse of that is that we recognize things that fail and we don't recognize that perhaps things are different now. I try to remind myself that just because it didn't work in the past does not make won't work this time. There are plenty of examples like that. I mean, even a company like Zoom, you know, who it was everybody was convinced that you couldn't build another company like a video a collaboration company. So there's plenty of examples like that. We always try and remind ourselves of that, but it's a human failure. We need to narrow things down. We need to look for patterns, and so that means you're quick also to eliminate certain things. Also based on patterns, including entrepreneurs. There are entrepreneurs who have failed time after time after time, and they come back, and it's what, do you ignore that? No. Are they guaranteed to fail again? Also no. But you have to make a decision. So I don't know if there's anything beyond making sure there are younger investors around the table who perhaps don't have the same kind of history and bias that more experienced investors do. I know we benefit from having young investors around the table. They force us to look at things slightly differently, and that's great. There's another issue. We sometimes in an existing company, I've seen it in its prior round, and I have a certain what we would call anchoring bias, where I can't get out of my mind, you know, a bad impression from the previous meeting. Or different valuation expectations. So there's a lot of psychology in this business, and unfortunately, it's also the kind of that forces you to make the wrong decisions or miss opportunities. But it's also what enables you to make decisions to begin with. So, you know, as an investor, you have to accept that you're not going to be right with all the investments. You're definitely not going to win all the good investments. Nor are you supposed to. You're supposed to be rewarded and judged on the investments you do make and how you manage them. And that's ultimately also what, you know, if you do that right, it's what wins you the reputation and backing to see better deals in the future and to win them when you want to.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I wanted to touch on another thing. Last year, Bessemer made public some of its most intriguing investment memos. And you wrote there that for VCs, learning from mistakes is easy because we make so many that we're experts on what not to do. But what's hard is to learn from success. How did you spot those baby unicorns in the wild? And I wanted to ask, what did you take from reviewing those memos? What was the common thread that you identified?
Well, the common thread, of course, is Bessemer, and those were all very successful companies, but There are different types of companies there, or memos. Again, this is an example of us memorializing our thought, you know, kind of a snapshot in time. Some of them will look like they were prescient, meaning whatever the company was doing at the time, they continued to do, and they did well for the next decade, leading to a massive exit or IPO, including highlighting the correct challenges and how the company might overcome them. You know, you can learn some things from that, but there are also a fair share of memos there that where what you see is that the company really changed its model or changed its product or how raw it was. And that's also very telling. There are multiple ways to succeed. And I think these are long-term commitments. And time entails lots of change in the market, change in the people, in the funding environment. And you have to be prepared for the change. As an investor, and of course, you want to back people who are going to be able to handle those changes. You know, perhaps if you look at those memos and you base them on kind of what the market was doing at the same time, you'll discover that some of them existed only during a bull market, meaning the last 10 years. Others had very important experiences going back to 2008. For instance, one of my companies, Wix, they were hit with the economic crisis of 2008, when all of a sudden funding did dry up, and we had to very quickly find and make a decision on how we're going to monetize. And that was pivotal for the company. It was post our investment, of course. But those are things you can't anticipate in a memo. Unfortunately, you know, we don't always write exit memos where we describe the whole history of the company. Occasionally, we write small ones for internal use. But those are perhaps the most intriguing for us to read and look back on.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty interesting practice to adopt, exit memos. I have something like a gazillion more questions, but we're somehow almost out of time. So there are three questions that all Kaufman episodes end with. And I know you haven't prepped for those, so shoot, don't think. What makes a great VC investor?
It's finding the way to have enough confidence to make decisions quickly, but not so much confidence that you turn people off or fool yourself into thinking you know everything. That would be the first thing. The second thing I would say about being a good investor is an understanding that there is a lot of uncertainty and luck in the business world, and that you can only control so much, and that anybody who says otherwise is lying to themselves.
I love that. What advice do you have for our audience? You know what better? What advice would you give yourself 10 years ago?
Well, I think one of the key decisions I made after joining Bessemer, it was a recognition, or it was a little bit, maybe a year or two after I joined Bessemer, it was a recognition that as an investor, despite all the pressure I felt and the risk I felt like that I was taking, I internalized that I'm not taking anywhere near the risk level of risk that the entrepreneurs themselves are taking, and not to ever forget that, and to be a true partner when they're challenged, in particular when they're challenged, when things are going rough or a bit rough, but also when they're doing well, not to treat them like thoroughbreds. You know, they're not working for you, and they're humans, so you have to treat them as humans, as people, with the dreams and fears and concerns, and to be the partner that you would want if you were in their shoes.
Yes. How do you stay sharp? Are there any books or podcasts or blogs that inspire you?
No, I don't have any particular blogs or books. I don't read much about the business world. I don't try and I'm so deep in this now. I find that it's endless. Yes, it's interesting, but I like to go further afield. I like to actually read books, sometimes magazine articles, but I actually go to fields like literature and philosophy and history and psychology and, of course, science. And I find that it's not only a good distraction, but I find parallels in our way of thinking. I find parallels in how companies developed and how entrepreneurs think or markets work. And for me, and that works for me. I can't always put it into writing what I learned from reading this particular book, but I do think it puts me in touch with people, because this is ultimately a people business, whether it's working with entrepreneurs or your company working with customers or working with an acquirer at the end of the day or other investors. So that's what works for me. I don't, one can decide to invest all of their reading time reading about the business, as they say, but I really enjoy getting out of the field. And of course, it helps to ensure that you have a balanced life, whether it's staying healthy, you know, just taking care of yourself, your body, you know, physically and mentally. It's important. The job requires a lot of patience and composure, and a lot of thinking. And the thinking goes on all the time. I mean, it goes in my world. It's between meetings. It's in the car, it's in the shower, it's when I wake up. So yes, I do need some distractions sometimes, but you do have balance in your life. So that's what I would recommend people.
2000% agree. Adam, this was fascinating, and I loved our conversation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Excellent. I enjoyed it as well.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kauffman Fellows.